Welcome to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyse and help define major global stories. I'm Peter Dobby. When the UK left the European Union, both sides agreed to a set of trade rules on Northern Ireland to avoid a hard border with the Republic of Ireland, which is an EU member. Britain now wants a new deal. The EU is offering changes, but is calling for compromise. So is this dispute about trade or politics, and could it endanger peace in Northern Ireland? OK, let's bring in our guests today. Joining us from Belfast, Owen Reedy, Assistant General Secretary of the Irish Congress of Trades Unions. In Brussels, we have Nicholas White, Senior Director in Brussels for APCO Worldwide. That's a global public affairs and strategic communications consultancy. And in Cambridge, in the UK, we have Graham Gudgeon, Research Associate at the University of Cambridge and formerly a special advisor to the former First Minister of Northern Ireland, David Trimble. Gentlemen, welcome to you all. Graham in Cambridge, coming to you first. The EU is offering some tweaks, some changes here. For the DUP, why isn't that enough?
Well, we don't know yet. We're going to have a look at the small print here. It does look as if the EU has made a significant effort to ease the situation and cut down the number of checks on goods going in from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. That's it. That's an internal customs trade board within the UK, which obviously is very uncomfortable for unionists because it makes Northern Ireland feel like a semi-detached part of the United Kingdom. So my guess is it probably won't be enough, but we should recognise, I think, that the EU is moving in the right, generally the right direction.
Nicholas White in Brussels. Why should EU law have primacy in Northern Ireland?
Because this is what the British agreed to when the Brexit agreement was first made. It's very difficult sitting in Brussels to avoid the impression that the point of what's going on here isn't actually reaching a particular solution. The point is to continue fighting because this goes down well with British voters. There was no problem, as your report rightly said, with the European Court of Justice as part of the Northern Ireland system as it's now operating. There's been no involvement, actually, of the European Court of Justice so far. This is an invented problem. And we're seeing now that some very generous movement by the EU, which is to be announced later today, has already been pre-discounted by the British government, who are simply more interested in having a fight than in finding a solution.
Can I contextualise that question, Nicholas, and ask you it again, though? Why should the European Court of Justice have primacy in Northern Ireland? Because the ECJ doesn't have primacy in Wales or Scotland. The UK left the European Union. Why not just say, OK, well, the ECJ has primacy in Brazil or Canada or Australia? Simply wouldn't fly.
Well, I mean, you may not have noticed, but there is actually a land border between the Republic of Ireland, which remains in the European Union, and Northern Ireland, which is inside the United Kingdom, but on the island. And in order to keep that border open, one has to make certain concessions, certain arrangements to do with regulation. And the UK, knowing full well what it was doing, agreed that the European Court of Justice should have a supervisory role on this. Otherwise, you have to invent an entirely new arbitration system from scratch, which actually won't do all that much work because there isn't all that much to adjudicate. In bigger treaties, which the EU has with larger countries, like, as you mentioned, Brazil or Ukraine, for that matter, you do set up standalone arbitration panels. Because there's a lot of work to be done. This isn't a case like that. This is a case where we're looking at the continued application of EU law in a territory where it had always applied up until now, and we're looking at how that should be managed. Why on earth should you invent a new arbitration system rather than the body which already oversees the implementation of EU regulations? It doesn't make any sense at all.
Owen Reedy in Belfast, what's this debate so far done to your members when it comes to jobs, when it comes to production levels? And if it goes south and they implement so-called Article 16, because everyone can walk away from this unilaterally if they choose to, what would that do to business across the border?
Well, thanks, Peter. It hasn't done anything yet because obviously we're still in this political impasse. But anything that adds to uncertainty, anything that adds to the cost of doing business has the potential to not only just undermine the standards of labour, but undermine the capacity of jobs to be maintained. And, you know, obviously the biggest concern is the huge political instability that this political impasse is continuing to create. And it seems to us, as an organization that represents workers from both traditions and migrant workers, that what we really need now is political consensus. It seems to me that in the summer months, the UK government looked for concessions from the EU. It seems this afternoon they're going to be delivered. And that must create the context now for a negotiation. And we really need to see diplomacy, negotiation and good faith restored to international relations here. And I think the UK government have some way to go to get to that place.
Graham Gudgeon in Cambridge, how much of the motivation for this, as far as Boris Johnson's government in London is concerned, actually comes down to him clearly wanting to safeguard the Good Friday Agreement? Because if he does that, that plays well to his Brexit hardliners in his own party. That plays well to the 52% of the British electorate who voted for Brexit, i.e. it's good politics.
Well, Boris Johnson is duty bound to protect the Good Friday Agreement. It's an international treaty and it's an important one. Important not only to the UK, but the Republic of Ireland, to the USA and many others. But the thing to say about this is that there are no votes in this for Boris Johnson. Very few people in Great Britain, in the majority of 98% of the UK, which is outside Northern Ireland, don't really care all that much about this. He's not going to gain any votes. He's doing this out of a sense of duty and out of a sense of morality. And I think, to be fair, we can also say that he had promised the unionists in Northern Ireland that there wouldn't be a border in the Irish Sea, and he's trying to redeem that position. He agreed the protocol 2 years ago when his government was in a very weak position. It's a bad agreement, negotiated or agreed at a time of weakness. It's not working. It's opposed by a large number of people in Northern Ireland. And it's time to change it. And in my view, it's in the interests of the EU to change it as well. This is a sore spot that could go on for years and affect all sorts of other relationships between the UK and the EU. Now is the time to sort it out to everyone's satisfaction. And my belief is that it can be sorted out.
Nicholas White in Brussels, you were shaking your head there as Graham was talking about Boris Johnson and morality in the same sentence.
I'm afraid I was. Boris Johnson knew perfectly well what he was signing up to 2 years ago. He said that this was an oven-ready deal, and he won an election on the basis of this deal, which he is now attempting to repudiate. I don't see anything terribly moral or ethical about that.
Owen Reedy in Belfast, you allowed yourself a wry smile there. Is anyone in the room really surprised that Boris Johnson might be considering doing a complete U-turn on this if you believe Dominic Cummings, formerly a very close source of information, cheek by jowl with Boris Johnson in Number 10 until he handled his involvement with coronavirus wrongly and then had to be got rid of in a very delayed way, I guess. But he's basically saying in the Daily Mail today, Boris Johnson was always going to do a UE on this.
I don't think anyone is surprised, and I would agree entirely with Nicholas. The only thing that's really been consistent during the Boris Johnson regime is their inconsistency. I mean, not so long ago, David Frost was extolling the virtues of this agreement, the very agreement he negotiated. Now he's trying to disown it. I mean, if a junior trade union official behaved that way after negotiating an agreement with an employer, they wouldn't last very long. So, you know, there are issues with the protocol. It's a result of the hard Brexit that this Boris Johnson government sought and insisted upon. Some unionists have highlighted some very legitimate concerns. They need to be taken on board. And I think in the context of what the EU are going to deliver today, they will be taken on board. And what we really need to see now are voices within Northern Ireland being involved in this, because this is an issue that can't be done to the people of Northern Ireland. It must be done with us. And I think the UK government and the EU need to engage with civic society, the political class, employers, trade unions, right across the board in Northern Ireland to make sure that the issues with the protocol are addressed so that we can all move forward. Because you are right to say the Belfast Good Friday Agreement has been undermined by Brexit and indeed by the protocol. The totality of relations are crucial. And I think we can only restore that if voices in Northern Ireland, right across the piece, that want to build a consensus and aren't interested in division and rancour, but actually want to bring people together, are heard on our centre stage.
Nicholas White in Brussels, you've gone from shaking your head to nodding in agreement there. When the EU is talking about totality and it's also signalling, quote, creative solutions, what might those solutions be?
I mean, this is going to come down to technical fixes for the customs administration, which I'm not that familiar with. I understand it will require actual functional databases of commercial transactions and access to those databases from both sides. But I also want to pick up another important point, which is the consultation with Northern Ireland stakeholders, both elected and from civil society. The EU's proposals today apparently are going to include a certain level of consultation, which has so far been absent from the process. It would have been nice to have heard that also from Lord Frost yesterday.
Let's go back to Graeme Gudgeon in Cambridge. Graeme, can the DUP live with a de facto Irish Northern Ireland border down the Irish Sea between the island of Ireland and the British Isles?
No, they can't, because it separates them from the rest of the UK. As your viewers will know, there's been an ongoing campaign by nationalists in Northern Ireland, backed by the Republic of Ireland, to achieve in the long run a united Ireland that the majority in Northern Ireland absolutely don't want, I mean completely don't want. And a border in the Irish Sea moves you a step or two in the direction of a united Ireland. Therefore, it's anathema to unionists in Northern Ireland. And it will be opposed. And therefore, it's undermining the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, the protocol itself says that it's there to support the Good Friday Agreement, and it's absolutely doing the opposite, and it's causing serious social disruption in Northern Ireland, or has the potential to do that. And this needs to be sorted out. It needs to be sorted out so that the majority of both communities in Northern Ireland see this as a, you know, something as satisfactory. I think almost everyone agrees that the single market has to be protected, that there have to be some means of stopping illegal goods getting into the Republic of Ireland. But there are other ways of doing that. This is really sort of a sledgehammer to crack a nut, and it needs to be needs to be simplified and reformed. And we'll see perhaps tomorrow when the EU paper is published just how far they're going in that direction.
Nicholas White in Brussels, coming back to you. This EU olive branch that we seem to be discussing now seems to be, as well, annoying the French. Is there a genuine source of annoyance there specifically with this issue? Or is it just, forgive me, is it just the French being the French? Or is there kind of a backwash here from other sources of anger in the relationship between Paris and London? We've got the migrant crisis, we've got fishing permits being debated, and the French, for the past 3 weeks, have been hopping mad over the AUKUS deal.
Yeah, well, I can't speak for the French. I sit in Brussels, I don't sit in Paris. Look, the EU proposals have got French backing, or they would not be being proposed. So just settle that down. Yes, the relationship between France and London, between Paris and London at the moment, is particularly bad. Looked at in a 10-year perspective, it's a combination of fishing permits and the submarine deal with Australia. There's clearly fault on both sides there, but the current instability doesn't really help. And I very much endorse what's been said about the need for a more stable footing for this sort of relationship. It's true to an extent that we're looking at a situation where the protocol didn't have that much consent in Northern Ireland. Neither did Brexit.
Owen Reedy in Belfast, as far as your members are concerned, and you have members on both sides of the border, you have a strong membership in the Republic and you have a strong membership in Northern Ireland. If it's as simple as the EU being creative with things like the way that, for example, cooked meats and sausage meat is labelled, so sausage meat might go from being labelled as sausage meat to, and I quote, national identity food products, OK? Now, of course, there are some red top papers in the UK are going to go completely mental with joy if and when that happens. Of course they will. But if that's what it has to happen, if that's what has to happen, why didn't they just do this 2 years ago?
Well, I think in any negotiation, Peter, you need to know that you have an honest partner that adheres to the agreement that they have signed up to. And we haven't seen that good faith approach from the UK government. So if I were the European Union in a negotiation with David Frost or Boris Johnson, I would be incredibly cautious about making concessions, because it seems any concession you make, it's rejected even before the concession is made. So I think people need to look at that. But if I could just very briefly come back on something Graeme said, I agree with him when he says the protocol or a protocol needs the support of both communities. But there is a border in the island of Ireland, and it's soft, and we need to keep it soft. But there has been a border in the Irish Sea for years. It's called devolution. The UK is not a unitary state. There are rules and laws in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales and England that are different. Now, we don't want to see any additional border infrastructure between Northern Ireland and Britain, but we don't want to see it between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. So it's about squaring that circle, and it's about moving away from zero sum, I win, you lose, and black and white, because it's a lot more grey. And I think it's about compromising, and it's about being people being confident. But that can only happen if they're empowered. And, you know, I don't think everyone in Northern Ireland, irrespective of their political tradition, wants to rely on the UK government to do their bidding for them. And that's why voices in Northern Ireland, whether they're unionist or nationalist or other, need to be heard more.
Graham, there are voices, perhaps not in Northern Ireland, but elsewhere in the EU, talking about potential here. If it all goes belly up, they're talking about the potential here for a trade war. Tariffs out of the UK or tariffed goods out of the UK, say it's sausage meat, cooked meats, that's one thing. But if you start imposing tariffs on luxury goods, you know, bottles of malt whiskey, luxury motor cars, that's a completely different ballgame. How far down that road, potentially, is the European Union prepared to go?
Not very far, I don't think. The protocol itself says that if either side invokes Article 16, which will suspend parts of the protocol, then any reaction has to be proportionate. And the amount of trade we're talking about is so small that the proportionate action would also have to be small. I mean, if the EU wants to up the ante here and start a trade war, then, I mean, that would be an extremely silly thing to do. This is a small matter, but there's very little danger here from the single market or for the EU. And it's time really to for the EU to take a step back here and damp this right down. Let's get this sorted. There are ways of protecting the single market without having the unique. I can't think of another example anywhere in the world where you have a major customs and trade border inside one country. That was imposed on the UK at a time of great political weakness and division, and the EU needs to recognise that now and sit down and agree with the UK a sensible way of doing this that doesn't upset as many people as the protocol already has.
Nicholas White in Brussels. I guess part of that process of recognising what might happen as far as Brussels is concerned is a calculation. The calculation has got to be, surely, what's the strength of feeling inside 10 Downing Street? How do they view the stance so far on the part of Boris Johnson's government?
Yeah, I mean, let's not make any mistake. The European Union wants to see this one settled and dealt with. But there is a strong perception that the British government is more interested in the fight than in the solution. And yesterday's speech by Lord Frost did nothing whatsoever to dispel that impression. And until there is a sense that Britain is actually interested in negotiating rather than fighting, the fight is going to continue.
Is it good news, Owen, that we are not starting this process this coming couple of days, couple of weeks, with a take-it-or-leave-it atmosphere on the part of either side?
Well, I heard David Frost's speech yesterday, and that sounded a bit more like a take-it-or-leave-it attitude, which was regrettable. I really hope that the announcement later on from Maris Šefčovič, that it creates the context for negotiations, where people can go into a negotiation in good faith, using the proper diplomatic channels, and without the megaphone diplomacy, where they can try and understand one another and reach an accommodation and an agreement that will be in the interests of the European Union, in the interests of the UK, crucially in the interests of all of the people of Northern Ireland and the island of Ireland. I think that's what's essential. And we need that space now, and we need to move away, as I said before, from the zero-sum game. I think the EU, though, also have to look at what's happening in Poland and in Hungary, because the rule of law and making sure that agreements are honoured and that commitments that countries enter into are honoured is crucial. So I think the EU will look at the context of that wider situation in any negotiation with the UK government, given the UK government's form up to date.
10 seconds each, please, gentlemen. Graham Gudgeon in Cambridge. A year from now, do you think it'll be a soft border or a hard border?
Are you talking about the border in the Irish Sea?
No, the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic.
Oh, that'll be a soft border. There's no question of a hard border there. And there are many ways of solving this problem without that.
Nicholas White in Brussels. Soft border, hard border?
For once, I agree with Graham. Soft is much more likely.
Owen Reedy in Belfast. Last word to Belfast. You're in the middle of this debate, Owen. Soft border or a hard border?
Has to be a soft border north and south, and needs to be a softer border east and west. It's in the interest of both communities and everyone in Northern Ireland.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for giving us your insight into this very dense, very complicated story. But I think we've managed to break it down into its composite parts. And dare I say, we've made Brexit slightly more understandable than it was half an hour ago. Thank you so much. Thank you to our guests. They were Owen Reedy, Nicholas White and Graham Gudgeon. That's it for this Inside Story podcast. This episode was produced by Calvin Ng, Maha Barada, Abdul Rahman Wasami and Jimmy Getahun. Sound was mixed by Sethil Marimutu. It was edited by Vinish Velilath, Ling Nguyen and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thank you for listening. We're back again tomorrow.